You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Club Rules by Kate Anderson Brower. The election of 2016 was the most rancorous in modern history, but before things devolved, Trump had a mutually advantageous relationship with the Clintons. He got affirmation from the presence of the former president and sitting U.S. senator at his 2005 wedding to Melania, where Hillary Clinton sat in the front row during the ceremony. "I had a very good relationship with both Clintons, actually. They came to my wedding, to the First Lady. They were there," he told me, which, of course, I knew because I'd seen the much-discussed, surreal photograph that showed the Clintons and the newly married Trumps beaming. The Clintons, in turn, got money. Trump made a $100,000 donation to the Clinton Foundation and other donations to Hillary's Senate campaigns before the two embarked on their jaw-dropping, no-holds-barred political feud. Bill Clinton may have been the reason Trump ran in the first place. He called Trump in late May 2015, a month after his wife announced her candidacy, and reportedly told him that he thought his message was resonating with frustrated conservatives who felt overlooked by the Republican establishment. He was intrigued when Trump confided in him that he was considering running for president. Clinton told Trump that he was tapping into a big part of the Republican electorate that was tired of career politicians. "It's a complicated story," Trump told me when I asked him directly whether Clinton encouraged him to run for president. Trump announced his candidacy weeks later. Clinton was a member of Trump National Golf Club in Briarcliff Manor, New York, 6 miles from the home the Clintons bought in Chappaqua after leaving the White House. Trump told New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd that he renovated the club in 1999 specifically to entice Clinton to join. It worked. "I'm proud to have him," Trump said when Clinton joined in May 2003. "He's a great gentleman, a good golfer, and a wonderful guy." Hillary even played golf there with her husband as part of his 65th birthday present. Remarkably, Bill Clinton still had a locker at the club during the heat of the campaign in the summer of 2016. New York-based radio host Boomer Esiason tweeted a photo of Clinton's locker that summer and wrote, "Next to my locker at Trump National, only in New York." When I asked Trump if he could see himself becoming friendly with a former president after leaving office or rekindling a friendship with Bill Clinton, as one-time rivals and former presidents John Adams and Thomas Jefferson had done, he said, "It's possible. Anything's possible." The target. A president unraveling his predecessor's policies is nothing new, but Trump does everything with unprecedented grandiosity. When he moved to the U.S. Embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, he tweeted, "I fulfilled my campaign promise. Others didn't." At a closed-door event with Republican donors in March 2018, Trump called the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq the single worst decision ever made. He said George W. Bush's decision threw a big fat brick into a hornet's nest. He continued, "Here we are, like the dummies of the world, because we had bad politicians running our country for a long time." Trump's attacks on Bush 43 have cut far deeper than anything Obama said during the heat of the 2008 campaign, and there are rare moments when Bush has let his frustration show. Bob Scanlon, who was a White House florist when Bush was in office, recalled being invited to a 2016 lunch at the Bush's Florida vacation home shortly after Trump won the election. When Trump's name came up, Bush abruptly ended the conversation and said, "Can we stop talking about him and enjoy our lunch?" Even Bush's brother Neil told me he has not heard him talk much about Trump. But one former Trump official who was friends with Bush had a very different interaction with him. When he told Bush that he did not want to say anything in public that was critical of Trump, Bush replied, "Why not?" "Well, out of loyalty," the official said. "Oh yeah," Bush said sarcastically, "because he's been so loyal to you." According to a Trump aide, George W. Bush and the president have a relationship that has progressed a lot, in part because of Trump's nomination of Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. But one former senior Bush aide, who is in touch with Bush regularly, disputes that telling. "Trump doesn't reach out for advice often, but President Bush's door is always open. Kavanaugh thawed some of the ice, but the ice is coming from one side." Any inference that the two are close is far-fetched, according to another close current aide to Bush. The ignored mentor. The tradition of the departing president's leaving a note for his successor is relatively new. Reagan started the custom, and as one would expect, his note had an ebullient touch, in part because the man who followed him into the White House was his trusted vice president, George H.W. Bush, but also because anything less than affable was not in Reagan's nature. "Don't let the turkeys get you down," was the note's heading. Reagan left the note on stationery with a Sandra Boynton cartoon depicting a crowd of turkeys trying to pull down an elephant, the symbol of the Republican Party. Reagan wrote it the morning he left office and stuck it in the top drawer of the Resolute desk. It was the beginning of a wonderful tradition. Bush's 1993 letter to Clinton was similarly lighthearted and encouraging. "I wish you great happiness here. I never felt the loneliness some presidents have described. There will be very tough times, made even more difficult by criticism you may not think is fair. I'm not a very good one to give advice, but just don't let the critics discourage you or push you off course. Your success is our country's success. I am rooting hard for you." Obama's note to Trump was decidedly less cheerful. In it, he warned Trump to sustain the international order. He asked Trump to be kind, a request found in no other letters between presidents. "We've both been blessed in different ways with great good fortune," Obama wrote. "Not everyone is so lucky. It's up to us to do everything we can to build more ladders of success for every child and family that's willing to work hard." He ended the letter by wishing Trump and his wife Melania good luck and offering to help in any ways which we can. Trump called to thank Obama for the note right after reading it on the day of his inauguration, but Obama was traveling to Palm Springs for a vacation with his wife and missed the call. By the time Obama had one of his aides call Trump back, it was several days later, and the new president had signed an executive order banning entry to citizens from 7 mostly Muslim countries for 90 days. The Trump staffer told the Obama aide trying to arrange the call, "President Trump just wanted to thank Obama for the letter. No need to disturb them now." The time for any hint of camaraderie between the two men had clearly passed. And then there were 4. George H.W. Bush's passing marked the loss of the patriarch of the ex-presidents. He was most loyal to the standards of the club, including graciousness and self-restraint. He did not think that a former president should publicly criticize his successor, believing that it would do lasting damage to the presidency if every sitting president had to be looking over his shoulder. The last former president to see Bush before he died on November 30, 2018, was not George W. Bush, but a man who had little in common with him on paper, aside from a shared job title. 3 days before he died, Bush, 94, welcomed Obama, the newest member of the President's Club, into his Houston home. That day, November 27th, Obama saw the man he called My Buddy 41 for the last time. Bush had been in and out of hospitals and was still mourning the death of his beloved wife of 73 years, Barbara, less than 8 months before. He had good days and bad days now, but Obama was someone he wanted to see, even on a particularly bad day. Obama was still less than 2 years out of office. He was in many ways the polar opposite of Bush, the patrician head of a sprawling family with roots in New England and Texas, and a decorated World War II Navy pilot. Bush already had a resume a mile long before he became president. Obama was born in Hawaii. His white mother was from Kansas, and his black father was from Kenya, and he served less than one term in the U.S. Senate before becoming the country's first African-American president. The two men were separated by generations and political parties, but they developed a genuine friendship, albeit one much less talked about than the father and son-like bond between Bush and Clinton. Obama admired Bush, who was among the last of the greatest generation. "Obama's a gentleman," Neil Bush told me, recalling Obama's call to check on his father during one stay in the ICU. "He looked up enough to my dad to show empathy and concern when Dad was suffering." Three photos on the wall of Neil Bush's office are of Obama. Dad worked hard to acknowledge the call, even though he couldn't really talk. As with any meeting between two former presidents, with the obvious exception of Bush 41 and Bush 43, who saw each other often, this one had been in the works for months. Bush's chief of staff, Gene Becker, was in touch with Obama's chief of staff, Anita Decker Breckinridge, to make a plan. Obama was going to be in Bush's hometown of Houston as the keynote speaker at the 25th anniversary celebration of the Baker Institute, named after Bush's Secretary of State and best friend, James Baker III. Bush told Becker that he would not be able to attend the event because of his health, although he told her he really wanted to see Obama. "I hope he stops by," he said. In October, when Bush returned from his annual summer stay at the family compound in Kennebunkport, Maine, Becker and Breckinridge began coordinating in earnest. While they are healthy, former presidents keep daunting schedules crammed with speeches, events, and looming book deadlines. The chiefs of staff to the former presidents speak regularly, sometimes with morbid questions, as was the case that previous winter when Clinton's chief of staff gave Becker a call to get funeral planning advice. The meeting between Bush and Obama was one that neither former president wanted to miss, knowing that it might be their last opportunity to see each other. Becker, who had been Bush's chief of staff since 1994 and was practically a member of the family, told me that she had a nagging feeling she could not shake. "I've never said this to anyone, but I remember quietly thinking to myself, I'm not sure President Bush will be here." When Obama arrived that November at the Bush's home in Houston's upscale Tanglewood community, Bush was having one of his bad days. He had Parkinson's disease and used a wheelchair or a motorized scooter, and he was not feeling well. His wife's death had shaken him. She had always said she hoped she would pass away before he did, because she could not imagine living without him. Now, he was forced to live without her, and it was taking a heavy toll. The day after Barbara Bush's funeral, he was hospitalized because of an infection that spread to his blood. When asked if he really was up for a visit from Obama, Bush could not be swayed. He replied, No, I feel good. As Becker ushered Obama into Bush's living room, she whispered to him, If it were anybody else but you, we would have canceled this visit. Neil Bush and Pulitzer Prize-winning historian John Meacham joined the two former presidents. George H.W. Bush was sitting in his wheelchair in the middle of the three men, smiling ear to ear as he sat quietly listening to the discussion, even though he was not able to participate in it much himself. Neil, who is the Bush's fourth child, told me that Obama specifically told Bush how much he admired his handling of foreign policy. After about 40 minutes, Obama asked if he could spend just 5 minutes alone with Bush. Everyone left the room to give them privacy for what would be their last moments together. When Obama was president, Bush returned to the White House several times, including two visits to the Oval Office and the unveiling of the official White House portraits of his son and daughter-in-law in May 2012. Obama's young staffers were in awe of Bush, who represented a different era in American politics, which, to be sure, was not always kind, but was not as relentlessly partisan as the politics of today. Before he needed a wheelchair, Bush walked up and down the hallways of the West Wing that he knew so well and teased Obama's aides, many of whom were in their 20s and 30s and were little kids when he was president. Have you ever gone skydiving? Well, what are you waiting for? He exuded graciousness and old-world manners, and because of his large, close family, he seemed to convey the message that politics is something that is a part of one's life, but should not define one's life. His kindness extended to private interactions with staff. Before Bush visited the White House for a July 2013 event honoring the winner of the 5,000th Daily Point of Light Award, part of the nonprofit encouraging volunteerism that Bush created and continued long after he left office, he called the Obamas' social secretary, Deesha Dyer, to thank her and her staff for their work in preparing for his visit. During their call, he told her how excited he was that he would be seeing members of the resident staff who had taken care of his family when they lived in the White House. It was quintessential Bush. A note from the staff. Trump has disparaged all the former living presidents and has not said much about the dead ones. The only president he seems to truly admire is the 19th-century populist Andrew Jackson. He has a portrait of the slave-owning general who fought Native Americans hanging prominently in the Oval Office. Unlike most presidents, who are too busy with policy to make decorating decisions, Trump picked out his wallpaper and rugs. He enjoyed moving Winston Churchill's bust back to the Oval after Obama had it placed in a hallway outside the Treaty Room on the second floor of the residence. Everything Obama had done, from letting the rug in the West Wing corridors get dingy to moving that bust, was anathema to Trump. He enjoys giving tours of the White House. During the walkthroughs, he reportedly points to where Clinton conducted an affair with Monica Lewinsky and shows guests the private dining room off the Oval Office, which he says was badly cared for and even had a hole in the wall when he moved in. He tells them Obama would spend much of the day watching basketball there. Obama's aides say there was no hole in the wall, and Obama obviously did not spend his days watching basketball. Trump has since gotten a larger flat screen to replace the one Obama used. A senior diplomat who has met with Trump several times said he has a reptilian brain and judges a person almost entirely by his or her appearance. Straight out of central casting, he often says of his aides and of Vice President Mike Pence, who, according to Trump, looks just how a vice president should look. Cabinet members privately lament Trump's refusal to embrace an endearing trait in any politician, a willingness to be self-deprecating. Like the former presidents, who are often frustratingly restrained in their public views of Trump, the 100 maids, butlers, chefs, and florists who make the White House run every day try to stick to a strict code of not criticizing the sitting president. Their jobs depend on it. Presidents and first ladies expect the staff to stay quiet. And they also sympathize with the enormous pressure that all presidents face. They see members of the first family as three-dimensional people in a way that few get to witness. Trump mostly treats the resident staff well, according to several recently retired staffers, even offering to slip them hundreds of dollars in cash as tips for jobs well done, only to be told every time that they cannot accept tips because they are residents' employees. Brian Rock, the head engineer of the White House from 1988 to 2017, and Joel Jensen, who purchased food for the family during a White House tenure of more than 30 years, between 1986 and 2018, described the Trumps as easy to work for. Rock said that when 11-year-old Barron Trump, like any boy his age, wanted to see how things worked behind the scenes and got a tour of the White House chill room, where the air conditioners that cool the enormous house during blisteringly hot Washington summers are kept. Ginny Botero was the head of the housekeeping department at the White House from 2007 until 2018. Instead of the chaos that many decry, what with the early morning Twitter storms and Trump's alleged rampant infidelity, she said there is relative domestic tranquility in the private living quarters on the second and third floors. It was interesting to see how his grandchildren interacted with him. They adore him, Botero told me. I'd see them sitting on his lap in the family dining room on the second floor. He was very gracious and very genuine when I worked there. There was this disconnect. I'd ask myself, what's wrong? Why is he saying that on Twitter? That's not who he is behind closed doors. I think he wants people to think he's a tough guy. It is a WWE match on the world stage, with the president playing a role he cannot and will not step away from. Trump's bluster is an act, according to resident staffers. No one expected Trump to win, Botero said, adding that the president can be surprisingly kind. Sometimes I'd walk up to the fence on Pennsylvania Avenue after going out for lunch, and I'd look at the protesters and think, oh boy, do they have that all wrong. But there are differences between the private world of this White House and the way things were when the Obamas, the Bushes, and the Clintons lived there. Rock said he had a strange experience the night of Trump's inauguration. Rock was in charge of the room temperature in the residence. On inauguration night 2017, he was getting calls from the chief usher saying that the president was hot. 2 minutes later, he would get a call saying that the first lady was cold. I asked him, who are we catering to here? Because 99.9% of the time we cater to the first lady. Only then did we realize they sleep in separate bedrooms. One recently retired staffer told me that she is in a book club where only 3 of the 20 members know that she worked in the Trump White House. If she told them, there would be too many questions, she said. Whenever anyone asks her where she worked, she tells them that she worked for the federal government. If they want more details, she tells them that she worked for the Department of Defense. People never know how to follow up on that, she said, laughing. But one longtime current resident staffer, who does not always agree with Trump's policies, lamented to me privately, there are days when I think, why am I making this person's life easier? It makes my blood boil. During our interview, when I asked Trump for his own take on reports of turbulence, he tells me that things are not always what they seem. "You walked through. We have a very calm White House," he says, shaking his head and waving his arms toward the office where his staff sits, called the Outer Oval. "A month ago, I was with 6 or 7 executives, and we were in a room where there was a television, and it was very calm, and we were negotiating some important thing for the country. It was on the news. Donald Trump is up in his residence, walking back and forth, screaming. They actually said, 'That's terrible. You're here.' And it was so calm. It's fake news. It's all fake news. It's really terrible," he says. "We have a very calm and very good White House."
Thank you.
murder at Sutton Place. When the surrogate son and alleged lover of New York's jeweler to the stars was involved in a brutal killing, some of the city's rich and powerful were entangled in a tabloid drama of sex, drugs, and betrayal that landed three men behind bars. But what really happened the night of Joey Cominelli's murder? By Christopher Ballin. Opening photo, bloodbath. Forensic image of Jimmy Rackover's apartment, scene of the victim's failed dismemberment. James Jimmy Bowdoin II was born the first time in March 1991 in Fort Lauderdale, the eldest son of a hardscrabble single mother. Then, in his early 20s, and hoping to escape the dead end of his past, he was reborn in New York City. In March 2015, not 3 years after landing in the city, with little more than the shirt on his back, Jimmy Bowdoin legally changed his last name to Rackover. For the court petition, he obtained the consent of a wealthy older Manhattanite named Jeffrey Rackover, a diamond dealer dubbed Jeweler to the Stars, who had become a surrogate father to him. While it wasn't a formal adoption, it proved a symbolic one, the shedding of a former self in order to don the fineries that New York sometimes bestows upon its most ambitious and adaptable newcomers. The two men didn't look much alike. Jimmy is muscular and tall, with a square, wide face of a brooding 1950s matinee idol. Jeffrey is none of those things. Nevertheless, for the sake of convenience and to ward off any implications of a sexual relationship, Jimmy was introduced around town as Jeffrey's long-lost biological son. Much was given to Jimmy Rackover, and much was expected in return. He wore tailored Savile Row suits, had his shirts made by Anto in Beverly Hills, and spent his summers poolside in East Hampton. He took the subway like two or three times when I first got to New York, and that's it, preferring Ubers and taxis. He used his Equinox gym membership twice a day, brought women on first dates to the Upper East Side Italian mainstay Campagnola, and hit night spots like Dow, the PhD Lounge, and Happy Ending. He had a full-time job as an insurance broker specializing in jewelry and fine art at Willis Towers Watson. By any estimation, his was a rapid ascent into the tight, often impermeable social weft of the city. "I always felt like I was meant to be something bigger," Jimmy tells me about his desire to make it in New York. For a long time, the princely reinvention seemed complete. Then came a Saturday night in November 2016, when Jimmy hosted a small after-hours party in his posh Sutton Place apartment that ended in a vicious murder. A little after dawn on that Sunday morning, as the other guests made their way home, four men remained inside the apartment. Jimmy, his best friend Larry DeLeon, Larry's childhood friend and roommate Max Gemma, and an affable Connecticut native named Joey Cominelli, who had been a stranger to the others until that night. One or more of these men is a murderer. Inside the apartment, Joey was violently beaten and stabbed 15 times in his chest, 9 on the right side and 6 on the left. The questions why, how, and by whom still linger. The murder itself was largely overshadowed by the brutality of the cover-up. After an attempted dismemberment in the bathtub, using a kitchen knife, Joey's body was wrapped in plastic and a bed comforter, tossed from Jimmy's fourth-floor window onto a busy Manhattan sidewalk, packed into the trunk of a Mercedes-Benz, and driven to a secluded spot in Oceanport, New Jersey, where he was set on fire and buried in a shallow grave. It would take 3 days before police found the body. I didn't see any of this coming, Jimmy tells me, sitting in a tiny cinder block room in the visiting area at Attica. Since April 2019, he has been incarcerated in the maximum security prison in the northwest corner of New York State, serving a sentence of 28 years to life for murder in the second degree. I thought I'd just be coming back from the Hamptons right now, like a regular cycle of my life. There are no guards or listening devices in the room, yet Jimmy is reluctant to talk. Since his arrest on November 15, 2016, he has not once been out of police custody, and in that time he has never spoken to investigators. He didn't take the stand at his trial, and he didn't speak at his sentencing. From the very start, he was cast as the poster boy ringleader of a sadistic, partying-too-hard murder. Footage of him being led out of Manhattan's 13th Precinct, wearing a midnight blue Prada suit over a white V-neck T-shirt, his wrist in handcuffs, became instant tabloid fodder. Yet he has remained overwhelmingly silent. Silence can save you, especially in the criminal justice system, but it also allows you to fit neatly into anyone's preferred version of events. Today, against his better instincts, he's agreed to talk, and when he does, he's composed and articulate. He wears a prison-issue magenta T-shirt, green drawstring pants, and black lace-up sneakers. His face is lightly freckled, and his hair is combed back in his signature pompadour. His left arm is tattooed in a sleeve of Japanese waves. The magenta shirt hides other tattoos. Only time will tell, calligraphied around his collarbone, and on his right hip, perhaps as an ode to his surrogate father, in tiny black cursive, "Diamonds are forever." Jimmy has a habit of pursing and chewing at his lips, a gesture that can be read as coy or calculating, as a sign of sincerity or deviousness. In fact, the difficulty of getting an accurate read on James Rackover, or rather the eerie liberty his face invites to project any characteristic onto him, became a key plank in his defense. His lawyer, Maurice Sirkars, accused the prosecution of doing just that at trial. In creating a profile of their prime suspect, investigators began to see what they wanted to see. Today, most people see a cold-blooded killer. Jimmy maintains his innocence of the murder, claiming he only participated in the gruesome aftermath. "I had people over all the time," he tells me. "Nothing like this ever happened. I don't get into fights. I don't beat people up. I'm very well known in the city, and I had a lot to lose." The autopsy report for Joey Comunale lists his date of death as Sunday, November 13th, 2016. But for everyone involved, it must have still felt like Saturday night. The city on that Saturday had been unusually charged with aggression. Demonstrators flocked to Trump Tower to protest the results of the presidential election, then only 4 days old. Mixed martial arts champ Conor McGregor headlined Madison Square Garden, taking on Eddie Alvarez for the UFC lightweight belt. Around 3:30 a.m. that night, the popular meatpacking night spot, the Gilded Lily, started to shut down. A fight broke out at the entrance, and patrons gathered across the street to have a last cigarette, call cars, or wait for friends. It was here that 26-year-old Joey and a friend began to chat up three young women from New Jersey who had been inside the club as well. Two other strangers joined the conversation, Larry, then 28, and Max, then 29, friends since elementary school in Oceanport, who were roommates in an apartment in Jersey City. Lingering on the sidewalk, these chance acquaintances talked and joked, not quite ready to call it a night. That's when Larry spontaneously invited them to an after-party. "Why don't you guys come to my friend's penthouse apartment?" one of the women remembered Larry asking. "His dad is like some famous jeweler in the city, and he is having a party." Max would later tell me that Larry was typically very shy in social situations, unless he had a drink or two. Larry had consumed several drinks by that point, as well as a few bumps of cocaine. Most of the others had, too. During the cab ride to the party, one of the women, realizing she was heading into the wilds of the city with a total stranger, improvised a quick safety measure. She took a photo of Larry and sent it to friends along with his name and the last four digits of his social security number, just in case you need to find us. The murky photo shows Larry in the front seat, glancing back with a playful, flirtatious smile. Even though the message served as a precaution, it was primarily done in jest. None of the women felt threatened, and one described Larry's manner as light, happy. It was Saturday night. Two taxis snaked through the Midtown grid toward East 59th Street. Their destination, a smoked glass luxury high-rise off Sutton Place that spirals upward from the shadow of the Queensboro Bridge. The Grand Sutton, like so many residential towers built in the 1980s, adds very little charm to the skyline, but exploits stunning city and river views. Larry's much-hyped after-party wasn't in the penthouse, nor was it in the apartment of Jimmy's surrogate father on the 32nd floor. Instead, Larry directed everyone to apartment 4C, a mid-size one-bedroom with windows facing the street, peering out onto the Queensboro's cantilevered arm as it begins its ascent over the East River. The host answered the door in a pair of jeans and no shirt. He introduced himself as James Rackover. Throughout the party, Jimmy repeatedly found ways to mention his wealthy father, showing off a framed photo of the two together, and remarking that his father could clean a ring that one of the women was wearing. At that point, one guest later told the jury, "I was like, we get it, your dad's a jeweler." Among the promises that New York City makes is that by sheer determination, you can turn fiction into fact and become the person you dream of being. 8 scowling mugshots from 2007 to 2011 show James Bowdoin progressing from a 16-year-old Fort Lauderdale high schooler to a 20-year-old boatyard worker fresh from a year-long stint in prison. Lined up, the mugshots read like the inverse of yearbook photographs, documenting a more optimistic march toward maturity. After Jimmy's arrest for Joey's murder, his lengthy criminal record was invoked to demonstrate the inherently rotten character lurking underneath the masquerade of a well-dressed, well-connected Manhattanite. Jimmy's Florida rap sheet includes trespassing, burglary, strong-armed robbery, drug possession, and cutting off his ankle monitor to spend a month on the lam. Nevertheless, Jimmy bristles at being called a career criminal. "I was 16, 17, he says. "I did some stupid shit with my friends. This was years ago." Jimmy is the opposite of what he's portrayed as being, his mother Erin Boyd assures me. He was, throughout his life, a rescuer. We still have the last dog he rescued. One glaring problem in Jimmy's childhood was his lack of a stable father figure. "I was a single mom," Boyd says. "It was very sporadic that the biological dad would show up." Jimmy tells me he never met his real father, a discrepancy perhaps explained by the fact that he always suspected he had a different father from his younger siblings. "I just grew up figuring the world out on my own," he says. "It's no shot at my mom or my upbringing. I did amazing up until a few years ago when this all happened. I mean, it worked. I made it." Jimmy's making it hinged on his decision at age 21 to start fresh in New York. Memories of the city's endless possibilities still bring out a smile. I feel like New York made me, he says. It turned me into the person I am. It gives you that edge. I feel more like a New Yorker than I do like a kid from Florida. In the wake of Joey's murder, and particularly in light of Jimmy's unorthodox relationship with Jeffrey Rackover, there was unending speculation as to how Jimmy made money in New York. In the press, he was labeled a kept boy and Jeffrey's lover, the notion of surrogate father swapped out for sugar daddy. The media became fixated on Jimmy's sexuality, or rather its flexibility for the right amount of cash. The Daily Mail dredged up an ex-girlfriend in Florida who, while swearing Jimmy was 100% straight, postulated that it was possible he turned tricks with older gay men. In lieu of any hard evidence, she referenced his sudden obsession with money and designer clothes. Or, in other words, he was starting to act more like a New Yorker than like a kid from Florida. The murder victim's father, Pat Comunale, would eventually file a series of civil suits against Jeffrey and the Grand Sutton, among others, that also traded in this gay-for-pay narrative, accusing Jimmy of exchanging sexual favors with affluent men in return for profit, social status, and illegal substances. Allegations in a civil suit summons do not need to meet a burden of proof, which means there may or may not be evidence of hustler activity in Jimmy's past. As salacious as gay prostitution was to the interested public, it had serious implications at Jimmy's trial. Time and again, prosecutors would seize upon the unearned privilege that Jimmy had enjoyed thanks to his special relationship with Daddy, in a sense, following the familiar morality trope so often used against homosexuality and sex work, that one act of degeneracy begets another. The question remains, even if Jimmy had worked as an escort, would that make him more likely to be a murderer? In reality, Jimmy's employment record is not atypical of most 20-somethings in their first years in the city. He bartended, DJed, and worked as a shop clerk at Ralph Lauren. He even tried modeling, posing for erotic photographer Rick Day, a standard go-to lensman for tear sheets. Nevertheless, his fortunes improved drastically once he befriended New York's jeweler to the stars. Then, in his mid-50s, Jeffrey, a well-tanned Long Island native and lifelong bachelor, had served as vice president of the illustrious British jewelry house Graff. In 2004, Jeffrey famously helped his friend Donald Trump select an emerald-cut diamond engagement ring for Melania. Trump reportedly received a 50% discount in exchange for the publicity. Jeffrey brought his celebrity client list, which included Oprah Winfrey and Jennifer Lopez, to his own venture, Jeffrey Rackover Diamonds, with its private showroom on Fifth Avenue. Days after Joey's murder, Bo Deedle, the retired police detective, Fox News contributor, and mayoral candidate, served as Jeffrey's spokesman in announcing that his devastated client had taken Jimmy in as a son after meeting him at a health club. Jimmy tells a different story of their first encounter, that they met over dinner in 2013 through a mutual friend. "We all went out, and Jeffrey just took a liking to me," Jimmy recounts. "He is the greatest guy I've ever met." Their bond was immediate, a relationship that many acquainted with them described not as sexual but genuinely paternal. In Jeffrey, Jimmy found the guidance and support he'd long been searching for. "Jeffrey treated me like a son. He never had kids, and I looked at him like a father. I still do. He put me on the fast track, the right track, and he brought a lot of balance to my life, a lot of, I guess you could say, discipline." In 2013, Jimmy was sharing an apartment uptown with a friend who had fallen into heavy drug use. It seemed likely that he'd have to move back to Florida. Jeffrey came to the rescue, offering a spare bedroom in his Grand Sutton apartment. It was the first stable home of Jimmy's adult life. Certainly, Jeffrey's friendship came with big material benefits. Through his contacts, Jimmy enrolled in 2 semesters at the Fashion Institute of Technology and secured the lucrative job as an insurance broker. But there was also another kind of education on offer, learning the customs and codes of a jet-set lifestyle. Jimmy patterned his taste on his mentor. His drink of choice became Johnny Walker Blue, which is Jeffrey's drink of choice. He traveled to London, Ibiza, and St. Bart, and to Las Vegas for the annual jewelry show. Through Jeffrey's close friendship with Fox's Good Day New York anchor Rosanna Scotto, daughter of Gambino crime family mobster Anthony Scotto, Jimmy became best friends with Rosanna's son, Louis L.J. Ruggiero. "He was like a little brother to me," Jimmy says of Louis, demonstrating his tick of conflating friends with family members. On the New York social circuit, Jimmy and Jeffrey first posed as friends. When that designation carried a whiff of the carnal, they invented a fictional tryst in Florida between Jeffrey and Jimmy's mother. A surprise knock on the door some 20 years later, a tearful reunion, and presto, father and son. It is unclear whether anyone in their orbit believed the long-lost son story. But there is little doubt that both Jeffrey and Jimmy wanted it to be true. "There are all these stories about him and I and all this gay lover shit," Jimmy scoffs. "All I did was go out and chase girls." One motive in taking Jeffrey's name was to shut down those insinuations. But once their ruse was uncovered, it only encouraged the speculation. According to Jimmy, the name change was Jeffrey's idea. It was a complete honor. In late 2015, Jeffrey helped Jimmy secure his own apartment in the Grand Sutton. Jimmy covered the walls in chocolate brown suede, accented the decor with Louis Vuitton trunks and cashmere throws, and hung Art Deco French liqueur posters. Jimmy swears he wasn't simply living on Jeffrey's largesse, insisting that he paid his own bills, including rent. "If you listen to the media, I partied 7 nights a week, twice on Sundays. I'm at work Monday to Friday. I have a great career. I'm in the gym nonstop. So if I go out one night on the weekends, I'm a bad guy now. So does everybody else in New York City. I felt a lot of this trial was based on my lifestyle, not on what actually happened." Not everyone was seduced by Jimmy's Araviste lifestyle. Max, Larry's friend and roommate, was not a fan. Max is no stranger to privilege. His father, Gordon Gemma, a real estate attorney, served as the mayor of Oceanport before becoming the director of property development in New Jersey for Trump's in-laws, the Kushners. He now works as a consultant for billion-dollar real estate developer Penepinto Properties in Jersey City. "I always thought Jimmy was really strange," Max tells me. "Something seemed off. Also, he was super flashy. He loved showing off his Gucci belt or whatever the hell he was wearing." And yet Larry, who also comes from a wealthy Oceanport family that works in construction and owns racehorses, found in Jimmy a kindred spirit. When I ask what Larry saw in Jimmy, Max answers candidly, "I'm assuming the attraction for Larry was that he liked some of the flashy stuff, too." Jimmy and Larry met in March 2016, 8 months before the murder. They became each other's wingman, both interested in sports and fitness, and both with plenty of spending money. It is also alleged by Larry that they both took steroids. While Jimmy describes himself as docile, Larry was known to have a volatile temper. He'd racked up a rap sheet of disorderly persons charges for bar fights along the Jersey Shore. According to Max, Larry wasn't a bully, but he had his own version of honor and making sure that it was kept. Jimmy recalls witnessing Larry's short fuse firsthand. He got into a bunch of fights. He liked to fight. I was like, dude, you can't do that. We've got too much to lose. If we hit a kid and, God forbid, he falls, he hits his head on the bar, he dies or something, anything could happen. For what? Because he's looking at us? We're good-looking guys. People are going to look at us, man. On the evening of the party, Jimmy had gone to a Friendsgiving and returned to his apartment by 9:30. He wasn't alone. A woman he was seeing came over to hook up and fell asleep in his bedroom. Jimmy watched the McGregor fight and planned to go to sleep when Larry texted from outside the Gilded Lily. It was late. They wanted somewhere to go, have a few drinks, party a little more, Jimmy recalls. He took pride in his generosity. I'm a very good host. Jeffrey taught me really well. My home was always open to my friends. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.